Chapters 8 and 9. Arguments whereby seemingly it is proved that evil is a nature or a thing. It would seem that certain arguments militate against the aforesaid statement, for each thing derives its species from its proper difference. Now evil is a specific difference in certain genera, namely in moral habits and acts, because as virtue according to its species is a good habit, so the contrary vice is an evil habit according to its species, and the same applies to virtuous and vicious acts. Therefore evil gives certain things their species, therefore it is an essence, and is natural to certain things. Further, each of two contraries is a nature, for if it predicated nothing, one of the contraries would be a pure privation or negation. But good and evil are stated to be contraries, therefore evil is a nature. Again, Aristotle in his Predicaments says that good and evil are the genera of contraries. Now every genus has an essence or nature, for there are no species or differences of non-being, so that what is not cannot be a genus. Therefore evil is an essence and a nature. Also, whatever is active is a thing. Now evil as such is active, for it counteracts and corrupts good. Therefore evil as such is a thing. Moreover, whatever can be more or less must be a thing, admitting of degrees, since negations and privations do not admit of being more or less. Now among evils we find one to be worse than another. Therefore seemingly, evil must be a thing. Furthermore, thing and being are convertible terms. Now evil exists in the world, therefore it is a thing and a nature. These objections, however, are easily solved, for evil and good in morals are said to be specific differences, as the first argument stated, because morality depends on the will, for a thing comes under the head of morals so far as it is voluntary. Now the will's object is the end and the good. Hence moral matters are specified by their end, even as natural actions are by the form of their active principle. For instance, the action of heating is specified by heat. Since then good and evil are predicated in respect of the universal direction to an end, or the privation of that direction, it follows that in morals the first difference is that of good and evil. Now for one genus there must be one first measure, and the measure in morals is reason. Consequently good and evil in moral matters must depend on the end appointed by reason. Accordingly, in morals, that which derives its species from an end that is in accord with reason is said to be specifically good, and that which derives its species from an end discordant from reason is said to be specifically bad. And yet this end, though it sets aside the end appointed by reason, is nevertheless some kind of good, such as a pleasurable object of the senses, or something similar, so that in some animals this end is good, and even in man when it is moderated by reason. Also it happens that what is evil for one, is good for another. Wherefore evil, so far as it is a specific difference in the moral genus, does not denote a thing essentially evil, but something that is good in itself. But evil for man, in so far as it removes the order of reason, which is man's good. From this it follows that evil and good are contraries, for as much as they are applied to the moral genus, and not in their absolute signification, as the second objection stated. But evil, as such, is a privation of good. In the same way we may understand the saying that evil and good, taken in the moral order, are the genera of contraries, on which the third objection was based. For of all moral contraries, either both are evil, as prodigality and stinginess, or one is good and the other evil, as liberality and stinginess. Hence moral evil is both a genus and a difference, not through being the privation of a good appointed by reason, whence it is called evil, but through the nature of the action or habit that is directed to an end incompatible with the right end appointed by reason. Thus a blind man is a human individual, not as being blind, but as being this particular man, and irrational is a difference of animal, not through the privation of reason, but on account of this particular nature to which privation of reason is consequent. It may also be said that Aristotle asserts evil and good to be genera, not in his own opinion, since he does not number them among the 10 first genera in each of which some contrariety is found, but according to the opinion of Pythagoras, who affirm that good and evil are supreme genera and first principles. Under each of them he placed 10 supreme contraries, so that we have the good which is definite, which is equal, which is one, which is on the right hand, the male, the restful, the straight, the luminous, the square, and lastly, the good, while under evil he placed the indefinite, the unequal, the manifold, the left hand, the female, the moving, the crooked, the darksome, the oblong, and lastly, the evil. In this way and in several passages of his works on logic, he employs examples according to the opinions of other philosophers, as being probable at the time. Moreover, this saying contains a certain amount of truth, for it is impossible that a probable statement should be utterly false. Now of all contraries one is perfect, while the other is incomplete, as containing some kind of privation. Thus white and hot are perfect, while cold and black are imperfect, as indicating a kind of privation. Since then incompleteness and privation are a kind of evil, while every perfection and completeness comes under the head of good, it follows that in contraries, one seems to be comprised under good, while the other approaches to the notion of evil. In this way good and evil are seemingly genera of all contraries. In this way too it is clear how evil is opposed to good, which was the line taken by the fourth objection. Because in so far as form and end, which have the aspect of good, and are the true principles of action, involve privation of a contrary form and end, the action that is consequent upon this form and end is ascribed to privation and evil accidentally. However, since privation, as such, is not a principle of action, rightly therefore does Dionysius say that evil does not oppose good, except by virtue of a good, and in itself it is powerless and weak, as not being a principle of action. Evil, however, is said to corrupt good, not only as acting by virtue of a good, as explained, but formally by itself, even as blindness is said to corrupt the sight, through being the very corruption of sight. In the same way whiteness is said to color the wall, because it is the very color of the wall. A thing is said to be a greater or lesser evil by reason of its distance from the good. For thus it is that things which imply privation admit of degrees, as inequality and unlikeness. Thus to be more unequal is to be more distant from equality, and to be more unlike is to go further from likeness. Wherefore that is said to be more evil, which is more deprived of good, as being more distant from good. But privations are subject to increase, not as having a kind of essence, as qualities and forms, as the fifth argument presumed, but through the increase of the cause of privation. Thus air is more darksome, according as the light is impeded by the interposition of more obstacles, for thus it is further removed from a participation of light. Again, evil is said to be in the world, not as though it had an essence, or were something, as the sixth argument supposed, but forasmuch as a thing is said to be evil with evil, even as blindness and privation of any kind is said to be, because an animal is blind with blindness. For being is predicated into ways, as the philosopher teaches, first as indicating the essence of a thing, and thus it is divided into the 10 categories. In this way no privation can be called a being. Secondly, as denoting a synthetical truth, in this way evil and privation are called a being, forasmuch as a thing is said to be deprived by a privation. Chapter 10. That the cause of evil is a good. We may conclude from the foregoing that evil is not caused except by a good. For were some evil caused by an evil, since evil does not act save by virtue of a good, as proved above, it follows that good itself is the primary cause of evil. Again, that which is not the cause of anything. Therefore every cause must be some being. Now evil is not a being, as shown above. Therefore evil cannot be the cause of anything. Hence if evil be caused by something, this must be a good. Again, whatever is properly and by itself the cause of something intends its proper effect. Hence, if evil by itself be the cause of something, it would intend its proper effect, namely evil. But this is false, for it has been shown that every agent intends a good. Therefore evil is not the cause of anything by itself, but only accidentally. Now every accidental cause is reduced to a per se cause, but good alone can be a per se cause, and evil cannot be a per se cause. Therefore, evil is caused by good. Further, every cause is either matter, or form, or agent, or end. But evil cannot be either matter or form, for it has been shown above that being, whether actual or potential, is a good. Neither can it be an agent, since a thing acts for as much as it is actual and has a form. Nor again can it be an end, since it is beside the intention, as we have shown. Therefore, evil cannot be the cause of a thing, and if anything be the cause of an evil, that evil must be caused by a good. Since, however, evil and good are opposite to each other, and one opposite cannot be the cause of the other except accidentally, thus a cold thing causes heat, as stated in Physics 8. 1. It follows that good cannot be the effective cause of evil except accidentally. In the physical order, this accident may be on the part of the agent, or on the part of the effect. On the part of the agent, as when the agent's power is defective, the result being that the action is defective, and the effect deficient. Thus, when the power of the digestive organ is defective, the result is imperfect digestion of the food and an indigested humor, which are physical evils. Now it is accidental to the agent as such, that its power be defective, for it acts not as having a defective power, but as having some power, for if it lacked power altogether, it would not act at all. Accordingly, evil is caused accidentally on the part of the agent, forasmuch as the agent's power is defective. Hence it is said that evil has not an efficient, but a deficient, cause, because evil does not follow from an active cause, except in so far as this cause is defective in power, and in this respect it is not effective. And it comes to the same if defect in the action and effect results from a defect in the instrument, or in anything else required for the agent's action, as when the motive power causes a limp on account of crookedness in the tibia, for the agent acts by both its power and its instrument. On the part of the effect, evil is caused by good accidentally, either on the part of the matter of the effect, or on the part of its force. For if the matter be indisposed to receive the impression of the agent, the effect must needs be defective. Thus a deformed offspring results from an indisposition of matter. Nor is it put down to defect in the agent if it fail to transform an indisposed matter to perfect actuality, since to each natural agent there is appointed a power in proportion to its nature, and if it go not beyond that power, it will not on that account fall short of its power, but only when it falls short of the measure of power due to it by nature. On the part of the effect's form, evil occurs accidentally, in so far as one form necessarily involves the privation of another, wherefore the generating of one thing is necessarily followed by the corruption of another. But this evil is not an evil of the effect intended by the agent, as was made clear above, but of the other thing. Accordingly, it is evident that evil is caused only accidentally by a good. And the same applies to things produced by art, for art, in its work, copies nature, and faults occur in both in the same way. In morals, however, the case would seem to be different, because moral fault does not apparently follow from a defective power, since weakness of power either wholly excludes, or at least diminishes, moral fault, for weakness does not deserve punishment which is due to guilt, but rather mercy and pardon, seeing that moral fault must be voluntary and not necessary. But if we consider the matter carefully, we shall find that there is a likeness in one respect, and unlikeness in another. There is unlikeness in that moral fault is considered in the action alone, and not in some effect produced. For moral virtues are directed not to making but to doing, whereas the arts are directed to making, for which reason it has been stated that faults occur in them in the same way as in nature. Therefore, moral evil is considered as resulting not from the matter or form of the effect, but only from the agent. Now, in moral actions, four active principles are to be found in due order. The first of these is the executive power, namely the motive force, whereby the members are moved to execute the will's command. Hence this power is moved by the will, which is a second principle, and the will is moved by the judgment of the apprehensive power, which judges that a particular thing is good or evil, which are objects of the will, the one moving to pursuit, the other to flight. Again, the apprehensive power is moved by the thing apprehended. Hence the first active principle in moral actions is the thing apprehended, the second is the apprehensive power, the third is the will, and the fourth is the motive force, which carries out the command of reason. Now the act of the executive power already presupposes moral good or evil. For these external acts do not belong to morals, except for as much as they are voluntary. Wherefore if the act of the will be good, the external act will also be good, and evil, if it be evil. And there would be nothing savoring of moral evil if the defect in a defective external act has nothing to do with the will, for limping is not a moral but a physical evil. Therefore a defect in this executive power either wholly excuses or diminishes moral fault. Again, the act whereby the object moves the apprehensive power is devoid of moral fault, for the visible object moves the sight according to the natural order of things, and so too does every object move a passive power. Again the act, considered in itself, of the apprehensive power is devoid of moral fault, since a defect therein either excuses or diminishes moral fault, in the same way as a defect in the executive power for weakness and ignorance equally excuse or diminish sin. It follows, then, that moral fault is found first and chiefly in the sole act of the will, and an act is logically called moral, precisely because it is voluntary. Therefore the root and origin of moral fault is to be sought in the act of the will. But there is a difficulty, seemingly, attendant upon this inquiry. For since a defective act results from a defect in the active principle, we must presuppose a defect in the will to precede the moral fault. And if this defect be natural, it will always adhere to the will, so that the will must be guilty of moral fault whenever it acts, whereas acts of virtue prove this to be false. But if the defect be voluntary, it is already a moral fault, the cause whereof will still remain to be sought, and thus the reason will carry on indefinitely. Accordingly we must say that the defect already existing in the will is not natural, lest it follow that the will sins in every act, and that neither is it casual or fortuitous. For then there would be no moral fault in us, since casual things are unforeseen and outside the domain of reason. Therefore it is voluntary, yet it is not a moral fault, lest we be forced to proceed indefinitely. How this may be, remains to be considered. The perfection of every active principle depends on a higher active principle, for the second agent acts by virtue of the first, while, therefore, the second agent remains subordinate to the first. It acts unfailingly, but it fails in acting, if it happen to stray from the order of the first agent, as in the case of an instrument that falls short of the first agent's movement. Now it has been said that, in the order of moral actions, two principles precede the will, to wit, the apprehensive power, and the apprehended object, which is the end. And since for each movable there is a corresponding proper motive power, every apprehensive power is not the motive force due to every appetitive power, but this one belongs to this, and another to that. Accordingly, just as the proper motive force of the sensitive appetite is the apprehensive power of the senses, so the proper motive force of the will is the reason. Again, since the reason is able to apprehend many goods and many ends, and each one has its proper end, the will also must have as its end and first motive force, not any, but a definite good. Hence when the will tends to its act, through being moved by the apprehension of reason that presents to it its proper good, a right action follows. Whereas when the will breaks away at the apprehension of the sensitive power, or even of the reason which presents some good other than its proper good, there follows in the will's act a moral fault. Consequently, the sin of action in the will is preceded by lack of order to reason, and to its proper end to reason, as when the will, on the sudden apprehension of a sense, tends to a good that is pleasurable to sense to its due end, as when by deliberating the reason arrives at some good which is not good now, or in some particular way, and yet the will tends to that good as though it were its proper good. Now this lack of order is voluntary, for it is in the will's power to will or not to will. Again it is in the will's power that the reason actually consider the matter, or cease from considering it, or that it consider this matter, or that. Nor is this lack of order a moral evil, for if the reason were to consider nothing, or to consider any good whatever, as yet there is no sin, until the will tends to an undue end, and this itself is an act of the will. Accordingly, both in the physical and in the moral order, it is clear that evil is not caused by good except accidentally. Chapter 11. That the subject of evil is a good. From what we have said, it can be shown that every evil is seated in some good, for evil cannot exist by itself since it has no essence, as was proved above. Therefore evil needs to be in some subject. Now every subject, as it is a substance, is a good, as is evident from what has been said. Therefore every evil is in a good. Also, evil is a privation, as we have shown. Now privation and the lacking form are in the same subject, but the subject of a form is a being in potentiality to that form, and this being is a good, for potentiality and act are in the same genus. Therefore privation, that is an evil, is in some good as its subject. Moreover, a thing is called evil because it hurts, nor otherwise than because it hurts a good, for it is good to hurt evil, since the corruption of evil is good. Now it would not hurt a good formally, unless it were in that good. Thus blindness is hurtful to a man for as much as it is in him. Therefore evil must be in a good. Again, evil is not caused except by good, and then only accidentally. Now whatever is accidental is reducible to that which is per se. Consequently, together with the evil effect that is caused accidentally by a good, there must be some good which is the per se effect of that good, so as to be the foundation of that evil, because what is accidental is founded on what is per se. Seeing, however, that good and evil are mutually opposed, and that one of two opposites cannot be the subject of the other, but expels it, someone at a cursory glance might think it unreasonable to state that good is the subject of evil. And yet it is not unreasonable if the truth be sought thoroughly, for good, even as being, is predicated universally, since every being, as such, is good, as we have shown. Now it is not unreasonable that non-being should have being for its subject, because every privation is a non-being, and yet its subject is a substance, which is a being. But non-being is not in an opposite being as its subject, for blindness is not universal non-being, but a particular kind of non-being, namely privation of sight. Therefore it is not in sight, as its subject, but in an animal. In like manner evil has for its subject, not the opposite good, for it is the privation of this good, but some other good. Thus moral evil is in a natural good, and an evil of nature, to wit privation of a form, is in matter, which is a good as a being in potentiality. Chapter 12. That evil does not entirely destroy good. It is clear from the foregoing that however much evil be increased, it can never destroy good entirely, since there must always remain the subject of evil, as long as evil remains. Now the subject of evil is a good. Therefore, some good must always remain. But seeing that evil may be increased indefinitely, and that good is always diminished by the increase of evil, it would seem that good is decreased by evil indefinitely. Now a good that can be diminished by evil must needs be finite, because infinite good is incompatible with evil, as we proved in the first book. Seemingly, therefore, sometimes a good is wholly destroyed by evil, since if something is subtracted indefinitely from the finite, this must at length be destroyed through such subtraction. Nor may it be said, as some say, that if the subsequent subtraction be made in the same proportion as the preceding one, and continue thus indefinitely, the good cannot be destroyed, as may be seen in the division of a continuous quantity. Thus if from a line 2 cubits long you subtract half, and from the remainder subtract half, and continue thus indefinitely, there will always remain something to be divided. But in this process of division, that which is subtracted afterwards must always be less in quantity, for half of the whole which was subtracted at first is greater in absolute quantity than half of the half, albeit the same proportion remains. This, however, no wise applies to the diminution of good by evil, because the more a good is diminished by an evil, the weaker it becomes, and thus it will be more capable of diminution by the subsequent evil. Again, this subsequent evil may be equal to or greater than the previous one, wherefore it will not happen that a smaller quantity of good will always be subsequently subtracted from the good, Even if the same proportion be observed, we must therefore find a different solution. It is clear from what has been already said, that evil entirely destroys the opposite good, as blindness destroys sight, yet there must needs remain the good which is the subject of that evil. And this subject, as such, has the aspect of a good, considered as in potentiality to the actuality of the good which is removed by the evil. Wherefore the less it is in potentiality to that good, the less good will it be. Now a subject becomes less in potentiality to a form, not indeed by the mere subtraction of some part of that subject, nor by the subtraction of some part of its potentiality, but by the fact that the potentiality is hindered by a contrary actuality from reaching to the actuality of the form. Thus according as heat is the more increased in a subject, the less is that subject potentially cold. Wherefore good is diminished by evil more by the addition of its contrary, than by the subtraction of good. This applies also to what we have said of evil. For we have said, that evil is incidental beside the intention of the agent, which always intends some good, the result of which is the exclusion of some other good opposed thereto. Hence the more we increase that intended good, the result of which is an evil beside the agent's intention, the more the potentiality to the contrary good will be diminished, and it is thus that the diminution of good by evil increases. Now this diminution of good by evil cannot go on indefinitely in the physical order, because all physical forms and forces are limited, and reach a certain term beyond which they cannot reach. Consequently neither can a contrary form, nor can the power of a contrary agent, be increased indefinitely, so as to result in the indefinite diminution of good by evil. On the other hand, this diminution can proceed indefinitely in moral matters, because the intellect and will have no limit fixed to their actions, for the intellect can proceed indefinitely in understanding. Wherefore the mathematical species of numbers and figures are infinite. In like manner the will goes on indefinitely in willing, since he who wills to commit a theft, can so will again, and so on to infinity. Now the more the will tends to undue ends, the more difficult is it for it to return to its proper and due end, as is evident in those who have acquired a vicious habit through sinning frequently. Hence the good of natural aptitude may be diminished indefinitely by moral evil, yet it will never be entirely destroyed, and will always accompany the nature that remains. Chapter 13. That evil has a cause of some kind. It can be shown from what precedes that although evil has no per se cause, yet every evil must needs have an accidental cause. For whatever is in a thing as its subject, must needs have a cause, since it results either from the principles of the subject, or from some external cause. Now evil is in good as its subject, as shown above. Therefore evil must have a cause. Again, that which is in potentiality to either of two opposites, is not actuated by either except by some cause, for no potentiality actuates itself. Now evil is the privation of that which is connatural and due to anyone, since it is on account of this that a thing is said to be evil. Therefore evil is in a subject that is in potentiality to evil and its opposite. Therefore evil must have some cause. Moreover, whatever is in a thing in addition to its nature, supervenes through some other cause. For whatever is natural to it is permanent, unless something else be in the way. Wherefore a stone is not borne upwards, unless someone throw it, and water is not heated unless something make it hot. Now evil, in whatever subject it be, is always there in addition to the nature of that subject, since it is the privation of what is connatural and due to a thing. Therefore evil must always have a cause, either per se or accidental. Further, every evil is consequent to some good, thus corruption is consequent to generation. Now every good has a cause, except the sovereign good, in which there is no evil, as proved in the first book. Therefore every evil has a cause, from which it results accidentally. Chapter 14. That evil is an accidental cause. From the same premises it is clear that although evil is not a per se cause, it is nevertheless an accidental cause. For if A is the cause of B per se, whatever is accidental to A is the accidental cause of B. Thus white, which is accidental to the builder, is the accidental cause of the house. Now every evil is in some good, And every good is in some way the cause of something, for matter is in some way the cause of form, while the converse is true in a sense, and the same applies to the agent and the end. Wherefore there does not follow an indefinite sequence in causes, if each thing be the cause of something else, because the circle to be observed in causes and effects is composed of various kinds of cause. Therefore evil is an accidental cause. Again, evil is a privation, as shown above. Now privation is an accidental principle in movable things, even as matter and form are per se principles. Therefore evil is an accidental cause of something. Moreover, from a defect in the cause there follows defect in the effect. Now defect in a cause is an evil, and yet it cannot be a per se cause, since a thing is not a cause in that it is defective, but in that it is a being, since were it wholly defective, it would be the cause of nothing. Therefore evil is a cause of something, not per se, but accidentally. Further, if we run through all the kinds of cause, we find that evil is an accidental cause. In the species of efficient cause, because defect in effect and action results from a defect in the efficient cause. In the species of material cause, because a fault in the effect arises from indisposition in the matter. In the species of formal cause, because every form is accompanied by the privation of the opposite form. And in the species of final cause, because evil is united to the undue end, inasmuch as the due end is hindered thereby. It is therefore evident that evil is an accidental cause, and cannot be a cause per se. Chapter 15. That there is no sovereign evil. It follows from this that there cannot be a sovereign evil. That is the principle of all evils. For a sovereign evil must needs exclude the association of all good, just as the sovereign good is that which is wholly disconnected from all evil. Now there cannot be an evil entirely apart from good, for it has been proved that evil is seated in some good. Therefore nothing is supremely evil. Again, if anything be supremely evil, it must be essentially evil, even as the supreme good is that which is essentially good. But this is impossible, since evil has no essence, as was shown above. It is impossible to suppose a supreme evil, that is the principle of evils. Also, that which is a first principle is not caused by anything. Now every evil is caused by a good, as we have proved. Therefore evil is not a first principle. Further, evil does not act except by virtue of a good, as we have proved. But a first principle acts by its own virtue. Therefore evil cannot be a first principle. Moreover, since that which is accidental is subsequent to that which is per se, the accidental cannot be first. Now evil does not occur except accidentally and unintentionally, as we have proved. Evil cannot be a first principle. Again, every evil has an accidental cause, as we have shown. But a first principle has no cause, either per se, or accidental. Therefore evil cannot be the first cause in any genus. Furthermore, a per se cause precedes one that is accidental. But evil is none but an accidental cause, as we have proved. Therefore evil cannot be a first principle. Hereby is refuted the error of the Manichees, who maintained the existence of a sovereign evil, that is the first principle of all evils. Chapter 16. That the end of everything is a good. Accordingly, if every agent acts for some good, as we have shown above, it follows that good is the end of each thing. For everything is directed by its action to some end, since either the action itself is an end, or the end of the action is also the end of the agent, and this is its good. Again, the end of a thing is the term of its appetite. Now the appetite of a thing terminates in a good, for the philosopher defines good as the object of all appetite. Therefore the end of everything is a good. Moreover, that toward which a thing tends while it is without it, and wherein it rests when it has it, is its end. Now anything that is without its proper perfection, is moved towards it, as far as in it lies, and if it have that perfection, it rests therein. Therefore the end of a thing is its perfection, but the perfection of a thing is its good. Therefore everything is directed to good as its end. Further, things that know the end, and things that do not know the end, are equally directed to the end, although those which know the end are moved thereto per se, whereas those which do not know it, tend thereto as directed by another, As may be seen in The Archer and The Arrow, now those that know the end are always directed to a good as their end, because the will, which is the appetite of a previously known end, does not tend towards a thing except under the aspect of good, which is its object. Therefore also those things that do not know the end are directed to a good as their end. Therefore the end of all is a good. Chapter 17. That all things are directed to one end, which is God. From the foregoing it is clear that all things are directed to one good as their last end. For if nothing tends to something as its end, except in so far as this is good, it follows that good, as such, is an end. Consequently that which is the supreme good is supremely the end of all. Now there is but one supreme good, namely God, as we have shown in the first book. Therefore all things are directed to the supreme good, namely God, as their end. Again, that which is supreme in any genus, is the cause of everything in that genus. Thus fire, which is supremely hot, is the cause of heat in other bodies. Therefore the supreme good, namely God, is the cause of goodness in all things good. Therefore he is the cause of every end being an end, since whatever is an end, is such, in so far as it is good. Now the cause of a thing being such, is yet more so. Therefore God is supremely the end of all things. Further, in every series of causes, the first cause is more a cause than the second causes, since the second cause is not a cause save through the first. Therefore that which is the first cause in the series of final causes, must needs be more the final cause of each thing than the proximate final cause. Now God is the first cause in the series of final causes, for he is supreme in the order of good things. Therefore he is the end of each thing more even than any proximate end. Moreover, in all mutually subordinate ends the last must needs be the end of each preceding end. Thus if a potion be mixed to be given to a sick man, and is given to him that he may be purged, and he be purged that he may be lowered, and lowered that he may be healed, it follows that health is the end of the lowering, and of the purging, and of those that precede. Now all things are subordinate in various degrees of goodness to the one supreme good, that is the cause of all goodness, and so, since good has the aspect of an end, all things are subordinate to God as preceding ends under the last end. Therefore God must be the end of all. Furthermore, the particular good is directed to the common good as its end, for the being of the part is on account of the whole. The good of the nation is more God-like than the good of one man. Now the supreme good, namely God, is the common good, since the good of all things depends on him, and the good whereby each thing is good is the particular good of that thing, and of those that depend thereon. Therefore all things are directed to one good, God, to wit, as their end. Again, order among ends is consequent to the order among agents, for just as the supreme agent moves all second agents, so must all the ends of second agents be directed to the end of the supreme agent, since whatever the supreme agent does, it does for its own end. Now the supreme agent is the active principle of the actions of all inferior agents, by moving all to their actions, and consequently to their ends. Hence it follows that all the ends of second agents are directed by the first agent to its proper end. Now the first agent in all things is God, as we proved in the second book. And his will has no other end but his own goodness, which is himself, as we showed in the first book. Therefore all things, whether they were made by him immediately, or by means of secondary causes, are directed to God as their end. But this applies to all things, for as we proved in the second book, there can be nothing that has not its being from him. Therefore all things are directed to God as their end. Moreover, the last end of every maker, as such, is himself, for what we make we use for our own sake, and if at any time a man make a thing for the sake of something else, it is referred to his own good, whether his use, his pleasure, or his virtue. Now God is the cause of all things being made, of some immediately, of others by means of other causes, as we have explained above. Therefore he is the end of all things. And again, the end holds the highest place among causes, and it is from it that all other causes derive their actual casualty, since the agent acts not except for the end, as was proved. and it is due to the agent that the matter is brought to the actuality of the form, wherefore the matter is made actually the matter, and the form is made the form, of this particular thing, through the agent's action, and consequently through the end. The later end also, is the cause of the preceding end, being intended as an end, for a thing is not moved towards a proximate end, except for the sake of the last end. Therefore the last end is the first cause of all. Now it must needs befit the first being, namely God, to be the first cause of all, as we proved above. Therefore God is the last end of all. Hence it is written, the Lord hath made all things for himself, and I am Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. Dash.